Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Hey, friends, it's me again. You know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. If you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in and give me a thumb. Say hi while you're at it. Helps me a ton with that damn algorithm. And besides, it's always nice to see you there. All right, then. Let's hop on that crazy train.
All aboard!
Shit. Welcome back, friends. I gotta tell you, it's a week before Halloween and twice as scary. That said, happy World Tripe Day from Casa de Blood. Delicious stuff, if you're a Chester, maybe. Oh, you'd love it, boy. Even tastier than waterlogged raccoons. But getting past that, I'd like to thank everyone who submitted to the Drew Blood's Dark Tales Spooky Season 2025 Rotten Contest this year. The votes have been tallied and the results are in. And the winner is... Red Bad Andy, with his submission, Precious Memories, to be featured on our upcoming Halloween show. Congratulations, Andy. I'm very proud of you. But also to the three runners-up, Piper Morrison, IDV, and Sebastian Simberg, who will all receive Drew Blood Dark Tales t-shirts. And honestly, congrats to all of you, because we've got your stories, and you're all in the running for a future episode. How's that for a happy ending? Well, come on in, friends. Let's get this trap on the road. All right. And remember, becoming a patron really helps us out. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com, hit the Patrons area button, and it'll take you through the rest. You'll get our entire catalog ad-free, and it keeps Craig's head out of the oven. So far, anyway. Tonight, we welcome back K.G. Lewis. This one comes from his collection, Flotsam and Jetsam, available from Velox Books. In it, we join a young fella about to have his world turned upside down. So without further delay, from author K.G. Lewis, Crone Lake. "Do you want to drive?" my dad asked, dangling the keys from his finger.
"Seriously?"
I smiled. "If you're going to take over for me, you need to get comfortable driving, Big Betty." He tossed the keys to me. Big Betty was the name he had given his tow truck, the vehicle my mom often referred to as his second wife because of how much time and money he invested keeping the old GMC running. Since I'd turned 18 earlier that month, my dad decided it was time I get involved in the family business. He assumed I was going to take over the company when he retired the way he had for my grandfather. I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was planning on moving out and going to college once the summer was over. I climbed into the truck and started her up.
"Where to?"
I asked once my dad had sat down and buckled his seatbelt. "The festival grounds," he replied. Every June, our small town of Foggy Mill has a week-long summer solstice celebration along the shores of Crone Lake. The most recent festival, which ended the previous night, was the town's bicentennial celebration. Last I'd heard, over 15,000 people had attended, breaking last year's record of 12,000. It's hard to believe that it had survived that long and had grown as large as it had. I'd heard it said around town that without the festival, Foggy Mill would have gone bankrupt decades ago. I know my dad made a killing that week, towing the vehicles of tourists who couldn't be bothered to park in the designated parking lots, or who had had a bit too much to drink and found themselves spending the night in the drunk tank. "How come you didn't want me to start working with you before the festival?" I asked as I pulled out of the driveway. "I could have helped."
"Festival week is crazy," he said. "There wasn't enough time to prepare you."
"You're just towing cars and taking them to the impound lot, right? How hard could that be?"
He turned his head and looked at me.
"That's the easy part. Dealing with the drunk and angry vehicle owners, that's where things get crazy."
I hadn't thought about that.
"Let's get you comfortable with towing first, and then I'll show you how to handle the people," he smiled. "By this time next year, you'll be a pro."
Only if I get trapped here,
I thought to myself. I hope to be long gone well before next year. When I pulled into the festival parking lot, I was surprised to see several cop cars and an ambulance parked over near the boat ramp.
"Another drowning, do you think?"
I asked my dad.
"I can't think of anything else it could be."
Crone Lake covered almost 50 square miles of countryside, making it a popular destination for people looking to spend a little time on the water. Most of those people know their way around the lake, but some don't, and that's when accidents happen. I can't think of a single year where there haven't been at least 3 drownings. Sadly, most of those incidents occurred during the week of the festival. I think that's because of the increased number of people visiting the lake at that time, but some claim it's because the lake is cursed.
"Pull up next to the sheriff,"
my dad pointed at the police truck. Sheriff Tate had been the sheriff of Foggy Mill for as long as I could remember. The only thing I knew about him was that he and my dad had gone to high school together. As I brought the truck to a stop next to the sheriff's truck, Sheriff Tate looked over at us, gave a quick wave of his hand, which my dad returned, and then started walking over to greet us.
"Morning, Seth,"
my dad said after rolling down his window. My dad was one of the few people in town that could get away with using the sheriff's first name.
"Morning, guys,"
the sheriff replied, leaning down a little to look inside the truck.
"Morning, Cole,"
he said to me.
"I see your father's finally had the good sense to put you to work."
"Morning, Sheriff,"
I replied, ignoring his other comment because I didn't know how to respond to it. I desperately wanted to ask him what had happened, but I didn't want to seem nosy, so I kept my mouth shut. Thankfully, my dad didn't have that problem.
"How many this time?"
my dad asked.
2,
the sheriff replied.
"Newlyweds. That's their car over there."
He pointed across the front of the tow truck to a blue sedan parked several spaces away from us. Painted in large white letters on its rear window were the words, "Just Married."
"We'll take it to the impound lot," my dad said.
A moment later, he added,
"Is that all you've got for us?" "Doris claims she has another at one of her cabins," the sheriff said. "But we haven't finished our sweep of the lake, so I can't confirm that yet."
"Well, we can swing by after we drop off the car and talk to her," my dad suggested.
"It's on the way back from the impound lot." "Let me know if you find anything,"
Sheriff Tate said.
"And I'll do the same. I've got to get back."
He nodded toward the group of deputies and paramedics gathered on the shore of the lake.
"It was nice seeing you, Cole,"
he gestured at me.
"I look forward to working with you."
"Me too,"
I said.
"All right,"
my dad declared after the sheriff had walked away.
"Let's go hook up that car."
Hooking the car up to the tow truck wasn't as difficult as I had thought it would be. The most time-consuming part was trying to line up the wheel lift with the front wheels. Once I was able to do that, the rest was easy, thanks in large part to my dad being there to guide me through the process.
"Take it slow and easy until you get used to the car being back there,"
my dad said as I pulled out of the festival parking lot. That's exactly what I did.
You can speed up a little,
my dad suggested when he noticed how slow I was going.
As long as you don't swerve or make any sharp turns, you'll be fine.
I did speed up a little, but it still took me twice as long to get to the impound lot as it should have, but I got there without incident. When I pulled up to the lot, the deputy assigned to man the gate opened it without bothering to come out of the gatehouse.
Pull up over there.
My dad pointed to the corner of the lot.
There should be plenty of room for you to back the car into that spot.
It took me a few tries to keep the truck and the car we were towing straight, but I was eventually able to back into the indicated spot. After that, all I had to do was release the car, and we were done.
Not bad for your first time.
My dad clapped his hand against my back. The two of us were standing at the rear of the truck as I secured the tire lift back into the resting place.
Is there anything else we need to do? Any forms we need to fill out?
Not for this one, he replied. Because it's tied to the accident victim, Seth will handle the paperwork. If this were just a standard tow, you'd have to fill out one of the towing forms and leave the carbon copy with the deputy in the gatehouse. The original copy goes into our files at home.
Where do I get the forms?
He popped open the side compartment in the bed of the truck where he kept his tools.
Right here.
He pointed to a clipboard that was attached to the wall of the compartment with magnets. On the clipboard was a thick stack of forms.
It's pretty self-explanatory. Just fill out as much information as you can.
I picked up the clipboard, looked at the form to see what information it required, and then put it back.
You ready to head over to Doris's place?
My dad asked as he shut the compartment.
I'm ready if you are.
Turned out my dad wasn't as ready as he thought he was. On our way back through town, he had me stop at the diner on Main Street so we could have breakfast. When we arrived at Doris's, she came out of the office to greet us as soon as I pulled into the parking lot.
Pull up to the curb and roll down your window,
my dad instructed when he saw her. Doris owned Crone Lake Cabins, a family-operated rental company that has 18 cabins spread out around the lake. If you wanted a place to stay that was on the lake, Crone Lake Cabins was your only option. Outside investors have tried to get permission to build more rental properties, but the city council has always denied their petitions. My mom, who teaches English and history at Foggy Mills High, said they did that because the town charter has strict restrictions about who can own land around the lake.
Well, what do we have here?
Doris smiled when she saw that I was the one driving the truck.
Good morning, Mrs. Welch.
How do you like it so far?
She asked, referring to working the tow truck with my dad.
It's okay, I said.
Well, if you ever get tired of working with your old man,
she gestured at my dad,
you can come work for me in the rental office.
Thanks, I'll keep that in mind,
I lied. Thinking about being stuck in that small office with her all day sounded boring. If I had to stay in town, I'd rather drive the tow truck.
Seth said you might have a pickup for us.
My dad wasted no time getting right to the point of our visit. The smile vanished from Doris's face.
Number 10. She was supposed to check out this morning, but I haven't seen her. I tried calling, but she never answered. And when I drove by earlier, her car was still parked out in front of the cabin.
Have you tried knocking on the door?
There was a hint of sarcasm in my dad's tone.
Not yet. I was going to let the sheriff do that, in case she was...
She paused and looked at me before looking over at my dad.
You know,
she finished cryptically.
He's pretty busy over at the festival grounds, my dad said. Might be a while before he can get over this way. If you want, Cole and I can go over and check it out for you.
And that's fine with me,
Doris agreed.
Let me get you the spare key.
She turned and walked back to her office.
What was she talking about?
I asked my dad once Doris had walked away.
What does she think happened to the woman?
She thinks she might have drowned like the others.
Why didn't she just say that?
My dad shrugged.
You'd have to ask her.
Could it be because she thinks the lake is cursed?
Cursed? My dad scoffed. I can assure you that Doris does not think the lake is cursed. In fact, you won't find anybody in Foggy Mill who believes those stories.
He stared intently at me for a moment.
You don't believe them, do you?
Of course not,
I said quickly. But there's a lot of people out there who do.
There are entire websites and social media groups dedicated to discussing the curse of Crone Lake, and none of them can agree upon what the curse is exactly. The only thing they can agree on is that the lake kills people. The most popular theory, unsurprisingly, involves witches. It's believed, but not supported by any historical facts, according to my mom, that the townsfolk of Foggy Mill used to drown witches in the lake, and that the spirits of those dead witches are still there, doing to others what was done to them.
The only people who believe that crap are people who don't live here,
my dad snapped.
If they did live here, they'd realize how blessed we all are.
This was the first time I had actually mentioned the curse in front of my dad, and I regretted it. Normally, I'd talk to my mom about it since she was an expert on local history. Whenever I did, we'd have an engaging conversation where she would happily debunk whatever new theory I'd found on the internet. I thought my dad would respond the same instead of getting annoyed as he had. I decided to keep my mouth shut on the subject. Thankfully, Doris emerged from the office a moment later, keeping the awkward silence between my dad and me from growing.
Here you go.
She reached across me to hand the key to my dad.
If she's still there, tell her she needs to pay for another night or get the hell out.
I'll let her know,
my dad replied, taking the keys. To me, he said,
all right, let's go.
Which way? I asked as I was about to pull out of the parking lot. I had no idea where I was going. I'd never been out to one of Doris's cabins.
Take a left and follow Lake Drive until we come to Willow Pass,
my dad instructed.
The cabin is about a mile from the Chapman house.
The Chapmans were the first family to settle in Foggy Mill, making the Chapman house the oldest original structure in the area. When the last remaining Chapman died in the late 50s, he willed the house to the town with instructions to turn it into a museum. The house is an impressive structure that takes up half of the island it was built upon. When I was little, I used to refer to it as the castle. I drove like I was going to the Chapman house until my dad said,
"Turn here,"
pointing at the wooden sign at the end of a gravel-lined drive. The sign featured the Crone Lake Cabins logo along with the number 10. I turned down the drive and parked in front of the cabin, next to the pickup truck that was already there. Even though it was referred to as a cabin, it looked more like a regular lake house with a strong country aesthetic.
Stay here,
my dad said before getting out of the truck. I sat there and watched him walk up to the front door and knock. When nobody answered, he knocked again. Before using the key Doris had given him, he walked entirely around the house, stopping to peek through the windows whenever he came to one. Once he completed his circuit, he motioned for me to join him on the porch.
What's up?
There's nobody here, so we're going to go inside, collect any personal belongings we find, put them in that truck, he hooked his thumb over his shoulder, and tow it to the impound lot.
Okay,
is all I said, even though I wanted to ask him if he thought the woman who was renting the place had drowned, as Doris had hinted at. He stopped and listened for a moment.
It's clear, he declared, motioning for me to enter. I'll take the bedrooms while you clean up out here.
He gestured towards the living room and kitchen area.
Pack up anything that doesn't belong.
I checked the living room first. Besides a few empty soda cans, there wasn't anything else in the room to show that someone had been here. I picked up the cans and tossed them into the trash on my way into the kitchen. When I did that, I got a view of the dining area, which was invisible to me while I was in the living room.
What is all this?
I said to myself, walking over to get a closer look at the stacks of books and papers that were spread out across the dining table. In the center of it all was a map of Foggy Mill and Crone Lake with several small red circles drawn on it. As I examined the map, I was shocked to see that one of the circles was drawn around the area where my house was.
What the hell?
I picked up the top book from one of the stacks and read the title, trying to make sense of what this woman was doing in Foggy Mill and why she'd circled my house on the map.
Cursed Lake?
I put it back and quickly read the titles of the rest of the books on the stack. They were all about Crone Lake, Foggy Mill, and the Chapman family.
Dad!
I called out.
You might want to come and look at this.
He walked into the kitchen carrying two luggage bags, which he dropped on the floor before walking over to join me at the table.
What is all of this?
I gestured at the stuff on the table. He walked around the room, looking at everything but not touching anything.
It's nothing, he said suddenly.
If it's nothing, why is our house circled on the map?
I pointed my finger at it.
It's not important, he said,
the tone of his voice warning me not to question him further.
Take those bags out to the truck and start hitching it up.
When he was done talking, he pulled his phone out of his pocket.
Now,
he snapped at me. I brushed past him, grabbed the bags, and left the kitchen, but I did not leave the cabin. I opened the front door and set the bags on the porch, then closed it again while remaining in the entryway. I stood there listening, waiting to see who he was going to call.
Hey, Seth, I heard him say. We've got a problem.
There was a moment of silence before he spoke again, saying,
The woman who's been staying at Doris's place knows something.
There was another period of silence before he said,
All right. I'll see you there.
When he was done talking, I heard him start to gather up things that were on the table. That was my cue to leave. A short while later, he stepped out of the cabin carrying two large file boxes, one stacked on top of the other. By then, I had backed the tow truck into position and was in the process of securing the truck's front tires to the lift.
Where to now?
I waited until he put the boxes in the back of the pickup to ask.
Home.
Why home?
To drop you off.
Why are you dropping me off?
I knew it was because he was going to meet the sheriff somewhere, but I wanted to see what he would say.
The person this stuff belongs to is dangerous.
He gestured at the truck we were going to tow.
Until we know what happened to her, I'd feel better knowing you were at home with your mother.
Dangerous how?
I don't have time to explain right now, he said, dismissing my question. I need to get this truck to the impound lot so Seth can look at it.
I knew better than to protest or push him any further. He had already made up his mind, and no matter what I said, he wasn't going to give me a straight answer.
Fine,
I said, walking around to the passenger side of the tow truck and climbing inside.
Let's go home.
As we drove away from the cabin, neither one of us said a word. We both just kept our eyes forward and our mouths shut. We drove that way for about a mile until a woman suddenly stepped out of the woods in front of us.
Look out!
I yelled at my dad when I saw her rush out into the middle of the street from my side of the road. She was waving her arms in the air, trying to get us to stop. As we raced towards her, I thought my dad was going to hit her because he was not slowing down. Not knowing what else to do, I grabbed the wheel and yanked it towards me, forcing the tow truck into the shoulder where my dad had to slam on the brakes to avoid driving into the woods.
What the hell is wrong with you?
He snapped at me.
What's wrong with me? What the hell is wrong with you? You almost hit that woman.
Before he could reply, the woman started banging on his window.
That's my truck,
she said. She did not look happy.
My dad rolled down his window and calmly addressed the woman. Your car was on private property, and we were asked to tow it. If you want it back, you're going to have to pick it up from the impound lot once it's been processed.
Actually?
The woman reached behind her and pulled a sleek-looking pistol from the waistband of her jeans.
You're going to give it back to me right now.
She pointed the pistol at my dad's head.
Your name is Cole, right?
It took me a moment to realize she was talking to me.
Yeah?
I stammered, surprised she knew my name.
Hop out of the truck, Cole.
She flicked the gun in my direction.
And release my truck.
I looked over at my dad, and without looking back at me, he said,
Do it.
I slowly opened the door and got out, making my way to the back of the tow truck. I briefly considered running into the woods and trying to get help while I was out of her line of sight, but I was too scared to try. I was hoping that if I did what she wanted, nobody would get hurt and she would leave.
It's free,
I said once I'd released her truck. The woman looked over at me. As soon as she turned her head, my dad threw his door open, knocking it into the woman and sending her falling to the ground.
No!
I couldn't believe how stupid my dad was being.
No!
I yelled the word that time as I watched the woman recover from her fall and aimed the pistol at my dad. He had only gotten 1 foot out of the truck before she fired. My dad's head snapped back and then he slumped to the ground. The woman quickly got up and started walking towards me, pointing the pistol at my head.
You're coming with me,
she said. I didn't hear her at first. I was in shock, staring at the lifeless body of my dad lying on the ground.
Let's go.
She jabbed me with the pistol.
Get in the truck.
She pulled a set of keys out of her pocket and used the remote to unlock the door to her truck. I couldn't get my feet to move.
Cole,
she said softly.
I know you're in shock right now, but I need you to listen to me, okay?
Okay,
I replied. She walked around the front of the truck to the passenger side and pulled the door open.
Come on.
She motioned for me to get in. Afraid and unable to make sense of what was going on, I climbed into the truck as she told me. Once I sat down, she shut the door and ran over to the driver's side, got in, and started the truck. As we drove by the tow truck, I couldn't help but look at my dad's prone body lying on the side of the road.
This isn't going to make a lot of sense to you right now,
the woman said.
But that wasn't your father.
I looked at her like she was crazy. I didn't see how that was possible. I'd seen my birth certificate. Both of my parents' names were on it.
I'll explain everything once we get the hell out of Foggy Mill.
I didn't care about what she had to say. She'd just killed my dad. There was no way she was going to be able to justify that. We drove in silence for a couple of hours before the woman eventually pulled into the parking lot of a run-down-looking motel. The kind that looked like it would be run by someone like Norman Bates. She got out of the truck and shut the door behind her, shoving the pistol into the waistband of her jeans before covering it with her shirt.
I'm going to get a room. You're welcome to stay with me if you like. If you do, I'll tell you everything I know about Foggy Mill and Crone Lake. Otherwise, you're free to go.
She gestured down the road.
The nearest town is a few miles up that road.
You're letting me go?
You are never a prisoner, Cole,
she said, turning to walk towards the motel office.
If you really want to know, you'll have to stick around and listen to the whole story.
As soon as she walked into the office, I got out of the truck and started walking towards the road. When I passed the bed of the truck, I happened to glance inside and saw the boxes of stuff that my dad had collected from the cabin. Seeing the boxes reminded me of the map and the books and all the other weird stuff I had seen on the table in the cabin.
She knows something about Foggy Mill, or she's just crazy,
I argued with myself.
If she's crazy, why'd she let me live? Why'd she say I could leave?
The longer I stood there, the easier it was to convince myself that I owed it to my dad to find out who the woman was and why she shot him.
I'm glad you decided to stay,
the woman said when she had returned from the office and found me standing next to the truck.
Help me bring this stuff inside and I'll tell you everything I know.
There were two beds in the motel room. I sat on one while the woman used the other to lay out a bunch of items from the boxes we had brought inside.
I suppose I should start by introducing myself. My name is Gabrielle.
She placed her hand on her chest.
And my story starts 30 years ago when my sister Tina and her boyfriend disappeared.
As Gabrielle told her story, I learned that Tina wasn't really her sister. The two girls had been placed with the same foster family and had become so close that they started telling everyone they were sisters.
This is her,
Gabrielle said, lifting a photo from the bed and handing it to me. Seeing the girl in the photo gave me a feeling of deja vu.
She looks familiar.
She should,
Gabrielle said, picking up a printout of a different picture and handing it to me.
This is Andrea,
I said, immediately recognizing the girl in the photo. In the picture, she was manning one of the refreshment booths at the Summer Solstice Festival. When I held the two photos side by side, the resemblance was incredible, but it couldn't possibly be the same person since the photos were obviously taken decades apart.
What do you know about Andrea?
Gabrielle asked.
Not much, I admitted. She hasn't lived in Foggy Mill very long.
When I first saw this photo,
she tapped the printout,
I thought I was looking at a ghost.
Where did you get it?
I found it online. One of those travel sites where members can post pictures of their vacations. It was taken 3 years ago during the festival. As soon as I saw it, I went to Foggy Mill to find her.
Did you find her?
I did,
she replied.
And that's when all of this craziness started.
She swept her hand over the bed, indicating all the books and papers she had collected on Foggy Mill and its residents.
When I saw Andrea, I was convinced she was Tina. She looked identical to her, from the placement of the moles on her cheek to the scar on the back of her hand. But there was no way she could be Tina. She was too young. If Tina were still alive, she'd be in her 40s like me. I left Foggy Mill feeling confused. How could this girl look exactly like Tina did on the day she disappeared? No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't let it go. And that brought me back to Foggy Mills a few more times, where I eventually stumbled upon this.
She handed me another printout of a photo. Like the photo of Andrea, I recognized the person immediately.
This is Dewey, I said.
I knew him as Sean.
Gabrielle handed me another old photo. In it, Tina had an arm wrapped around the shoulders of a young man who looked exactly like Dewey.
Sean was Tina's boyfriend,
I said, stating the obvious.
I thought it was one hell of a coincidence to find someone who looked like Tina. Then when I saw that kid,
she pointed at the printout of Dewey,
I figured I was going crazy, or something really bizarre was going on in that town.
She reached behind her and picked up a book that looked like a photo album and held it out to me. I set the photos I was holding onto the bed next to me so I could take the book.
What's this? I asked.
That's all the proof I collected to convince myself that I wasn't going crazy.
I set the photo album on my lap and opened it. Stuck on the first page were two things. A newspaper article about one of the drownings in Crone Lake and a photograph. Handwritten underneath both was a different year. Underneath the article was the year 1973, and underneath the photograph was the year 2003.
It looks like the same person,
I said, looking from the photo of the man in the newspaper article to the man in the photograph.
Weird, right? Keep going. It gets weirder.
I flipped through the next few pages and found more of the same.
Stop right there.
Gabrielle held her hand out as I was about to turn the page.
Look at this one.
She tapped the open photo album with her index finger. I read the article. Like the others, it was about another drowning in Crone Lake, but this one was different. It wasn't about a single person. It was about a family.
They never found the son's body,
Gabrielle said. Why is that weird? I asked. There had been plenty of other bodies that hadn't been recovered from the lake. My dad told me it was because the lake was too deep in some places to search.
It's weird because the day after that couple went missing, this little boy appeared.
She pointed to the other page where there was a photograph of a kid, no more than 2 years old, playing in the front yard of a familiar-looking house. The kid looked very similar to the boy pictured in the news article.
Wait a minute,
I said, suddenly realizing what I was looking at.
That's my house.
And that's you.
Gabrielle pointed at the boy.
No.
My first impulse was to deny what she was implying.
There's no way that's me.
I gestured at the news article.
I didn't want to believe any of this stuff either, but the evidence is all right there.
She flipped forward a couple of pages to another article about a young couple that had drowned.
Your parents are not who they say they are.
The couple in the article looked like my parents did when they were younger. But it couldn't be them, because the article I was looking at was from the 1950s. They'd both be in their 90s if it were really them.
In fact,
she took a deep breath, then let it out with a sigh before revealing another ridiculous accusation.
They're not even human.
What?
That was all I could think to say.
Did you know that Crone Lake used to be known as Coron Lake?
Gabrielle asked, changing the subject. I shook my head.
Coron is a French word that means carrion,
she explained.
Therefore, Crone Lake was essentially once known as Carrion Lake. It was changed to Crone Lake in the early 1800s because Crone was much easier to say than Coron.
Why was it called Carrion Lake?
There was an idea already forming in the back of my mind about why, but I wanted her to say it.
Because of all the bodies that kept washing up upon its shores,
she said, confirming my suspicions.
Something that's been happening every year, ever since the area was settled. Not a year has gone by without a body being found.
People drown, I replied, finding myself parroting the explanation my parents always used.
That's true,
Gabrielle agreed.
People do drown, but why is it that many of the people who have drowned are missing their hearts?
What?
I found myself unable to say anything else again. Her story was getting weirder and weirder and harder to process.
After I discovered all those dead or missing people suddenly living again in Foggy Mill, I started digging into the town's past and eventually started looking at its legends.
She placed her hand back on the stack of books sitting on the bed. All of them were about the curse of Crone Lake.
Through these, I was able to start piecing things together and eventually figured out what was going on. The final piece of the puzzle came to me by chance while I was researching the idea of witches and lake monsters and the other absurd theories surrounding the curse of Crone Lake.
She reached behind her and picked up a book. She flipped it open to a page marked with a post-it note and turned it around to face me.
Read the highlighted part,
she instructed.
The shapeshifter has been known by many names throughout history, including Changeling, Doppelganger, and Skinwalker.
I looked up at her.
Keep reading.
Despite minor regional differences, all these creatures have one thing in common: to take the form of someone
they must ingest a part of that person. For most of them, the heart seems to be the organ of choice. She closed the book and set it aside.
You know how crazy that sounds, right?
The idea that the town was full of shapeshifters was a bit much to accept.
But it all fits,
was her reply.
You haven't explained my part in all of it. Where do I fit? Why would a bunch of shapeshifters kidnap me and raise me as their son?
They're not raising you,
she said.
They're farming you. You and all the other kids they've taken over the years.
Farming us?
I raised an eyebrow at the thought.
What does that even mean?
I should have left when I had the chance. I was beginning to think the woman really was crazy, and that staying there with her was a mistake.
It means you were never going to leave Foggy Mill alive. As soon as your body was needed, they would have done to you what they've done to so many others.
Kill me and eat my heart?
I scoffed at the idea.
Maybe this will help convince you.
She pulled out her phone, tapped the screen a couple of times, and then held it out to me.
Watch this.
I took her phone and watched a video that was playing on it. In it, the sheriff of Foggy Mill and the man I'd been calling Dad loaded what appeared to be a couple of bodies onto a boat and drove them out into the middle of the lake where they were unceremoniously dumped into the water.
Still don't think he's a monster?
Gabrielle said, taking the phone from me. I didn't know what to think. The only thing I was sure of was that my life was a lie.
Your dad and the sheriff aren't the only ones involved with what's going on.
Gabrielle started unfolding a map. The same map I had seen with all the circled locations on it.
All of the prominent members of the town are.
Does anyone else know about this?
Not yet. I was waiting until I had some more substantial evidence before I went to the authorities. And now that I've got it...
She indicated her phone and the video it contained.
I'm going straight to the FBI as soon as I leave here. You're welcome to come with me if you want. If not, I can drop you off wherever you like.
I think I need some time to process all this.
I understand,
Gabrielle said softly, placing her hand on my knee.
I really do, and I'm sorry you had to find out about it like this.
We sat there in silence for a moment before Gabrielle stood up and declared that she was hungry.
I haven't eaten anything since last night. There's a burger joint a couple of miles up the road. Do you want to go and grab something to eat?
I think I'd rather stay here if that's okay.
I had a lot to think about and wouldn't mind getting to do that by myself. Gabrielle walked over to the motel room door.
I'll bring you something back. While I'm gone, feel free to go through that stuff.
She gestured at the collection of books and papers on the bed.
It might help you better understand what's really going on in Foggy Mill.
I didn't say anything as she opened the door and left. While Gabrielle was gone, I did go through the stacks of information she had compiled. One of the more interesting things I found was some notes she had written, detailing how she believed the Foggy Mill coroner was removing the hearts of the drowning victims during their autopsies. Apparently, she'd even gone so far as to bribe a funeral director the previous year, asking him to verify if all the organs of that year's drowning victims were present after he had received the bodies from the Foggy Mill morgue. The funeral director was surprised to discover that the hearts were missing from both the bodies, but Gabrielle wasn't. I was in the middle of reading one of the Curse of Crone Lake books when the door to the motel room slammed open.
Come on.
Gabrielle motioned for me to get up.
We have to leave.
What's going on?
I set the book down and quickly got to my feet.
They're looking for us. It's not safe for us to stay here. We need to leave right now.
After she finished speaking, she turned and walked back out to the parking lot.
What about all your stuff?
I asked as I stepped outside.
It's not important,
she said, climbing back into her truck. When she noticed I wasn't moving, she called out,
Are you coming or not? Because I'm leaving.
I'm coming, I said, running up to the truck and climbing inside. The tires of the truck squealed as Gabrielle backed out of the parking space and then gunned it, racing out onto the road. While she drove, I happened to look at Gabrielle's hands and noticed that the beds of her fingernails were stained red with dried blood. Seeing that gave me a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach.
How'd you find out they were looking for us?
What?
She replied, lifting her right arm to brush away a stray lock of hair from her forehead. As she did that, the sleeve of her shirt rolled up far enough for me to see the watch she was wearing on her wrist. I knew that watch. I'd helped my dad pick it out for my mom's birthday several years ago. After I saw the watch, I remembered seeing something else out of the corner of my eye as I ran to get into the truck. There was a tarp in the bed of the pickup that hadn't been there when I first got into the truck with Gabrielle that morning. I slowly turned my head and looked through the rear window into the bed of the pickup, where part of an arm and a leg could be seen peeking out from beneath a rolled-up blue tarp.
They're not looking for us, I thought. They already found us.
And that was Crone Lake by K.G. Lewis. Never turns out great when you pick up strange women on the side of the road, does it? A little about the author. K.G. Lewis is the author of 6 books on VeloxBooks.com, whose stories have been featured on many podcasts. He is also the designer of the tabletop miniatures game Giant Monster Rampage. He resides in Georgia with his family. Thanks, K.G.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at ChillinTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I'm afraid this is where we part ways, at least till next week. So grab a drink for the road, friend, and be sure to tune in next week to hear contest winner Red Bad Andy's tale, Precious Memories. In the meantime, check out Andy's 4-part story, Shipping and Handling, over on the Sinister Somnolence channel. What the hell? And hit me up at patreon.com/DrewBlood, too, if you're so inclined. So may the wind be at your back and may the road rise up to meet you. I'll see you all on Halloween night. Till then, go fuck yourselves. Bye.